The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, and you're very welcome to the show. We'll all stay calm now, right? Let's just have a quick look at the papers first. Sunday Independent, vaccine SARS supply will get back on track. So Breen McGrath is saying they're still on course, basically, for 80% of the adult population by June. The flame is lit, he says. It is flickering with fluctuating oxygen. It certainly is flickering with fluctuating oxygen this morning. The Sunday Times is leading with that Varadkar leak upgraded to criminal probe. So that's the inquiry into Leo Varadkar leaking that document to his friend, and the Taoiseach spokesman said his legal advice is that he has committed no offence. He looks forward to the matter being concluded. The Business Post, pressure on new Davy chief over firms misleading of central bank. So you could see this story keeps moving, right? And it's moving now. You can see across the papers onto questions to the board of Davies, and then clients, more and more clients, and that coming out and starting to express disquiet. The Irish Mail on Sunday. Dad's killers made me lie, and that's Jason Corbett's daughter, who has put up a post saying to her stepmother, "You took my dad's life, you destroyed mine, you coached me to lie." The Sunday World, legal high in joy, drug-soaked photos hidden in solicitors' correspondence, convicted coke dealer. So the photographs, I think, dipped in a Valium-like substance. The Sunday Mirror, John Joe, I'll work with Kinahan. That's Olympic boxer John Joe Nevin, signed up to work with Daniel Kinahan. And on a lighter note, the Sunday Telegraph, Kate's tribute as she recalls how it felt to walk in London at night. So a stroke of genius by Kate Middleton going down to that, not protest, but vigil last night. But look, obviously the breaking news this morning is that the administration of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine has been suspended in Ireland, and NIAC have been meeting again this morning. And Professor Corina Butler, who's chair of NIAC, is on the line now. And Corina, good morning and thanks for joining us. I believe that meeting has just ended. What can you tell us?
Oh, good morning, Brendan, and thank you for having me on and to give me the opportunity to explain to everyone what's going on. The last, 12, 18 hours have really been a very difficult time for us, because we're really in a crisis situation in the sense that COVID is here. We've got high numbers. We know that COVID causes a lot of illness, serious illness. And we know that COVID itself can be responsible for complications such as clots as well. Against that, we have the AstraZeneca vaccine that we're all absolutely delighted with in terms of its proven effect and benefit at preventing those serious effects of COVID. And particularly, we've seen the data from Scotland, where AstraZeneca was used primarily in the older population, and magnificent declines in hospitalizations and serious illness. So really looking great. Now, earlier this week, we heard that there were some reports of clotting problems in people following it. But of course, clotting problems happen to people irrespective of whether they get the vaccine or not. Just the way I might get the vaccine and I might walk out a step and fall down, and that's not due to the vaccine, it just was going to happen. And when the EMA looked at that, and the MRHA looked at it, and AstraZeneca looked at it, and in the numbers, the incidence of those events really was no greater than background than what you would expect in the population. So all of that was very, very reassuring.
Okay, so I suppose, Corina, people are wondering now, what has changed here
exactly,
so suddenly?
And that's where I'm going. And the EMA have started an investigation and are looking at that. And then what happened was last night, late yesterday evening, we got notification from the HPRA got notification from the Norwegian Medicine Agency that there had been what they reported as a cluster of four serious, very rare, very serious clotting events. Not the kind of the usual clots in the legs, but actually clots involving the brain or vessels that wouldn't normally be involved, and in younger people. So looking overall, it was a number of these very small but very rare serious events in people that you mightn't otherwise expect it, that raised a signal, a safety signal.
Okay, and Karina, can I just, I might interrupt you now and again for clarity.
Okay.
The previous clotting events that we'd been made aware of during the week and that had caused a number of other countries to suspend the use, are these ones different?
The majority of the other ones were the kind of normal, a clot in your leg or maybe okay. even a clot to the lung in people where you might expect it. There were some of these very serious ones, but they seemed very scattered and rare, and the initial in someone where there were other things that might have explained it as well. And it was just those and then this group on top of that seeming to cluster together, and we don't know that there isn't another reason for it.
Okay.
But
does this suggest also
was raised?
And does this suggest also that there is a batch issue here? I know the batches are about a million, but we had heard talk about a kind of a bad batch during the week.
Originally it was thought that maybe, but this isn't a batch related issue that wouldn't explain this. And so this is across batches, so it's no longer a batch issue. It was just a question, and the big question is, are these totally coincidental random events that have happened to happen around the time, because we're rolling out the vaccine to lots and lots of people, or is it possible that there could be a causal relationship, that the vaccine may in some way have triggered the clots? We don't know the answer to that yet, but because they were very serious and every serious safety signal has to be investigated, and because we above all want to ensure that what we're recommending is safe and that we can maintain confidence in the vaccine program, we felt that we had to pause, just pause, until we get the additional information that could possibly, hopefully, give us the reassurance that, no, this is fine, and you know what, we did this out of an abundance of caution, but you know what, we didn't really need to have done it. That's what I really, really hope.
Okay. Now, look, you use that key word there, confidence, and obviously there's a balance to be struck here because you don't want to panic the in excess of, over 100,000 people have had this vaccine already, and you also don't want to, there's already people texting in, a texter here saying, I was scheduled to have my AstraZeneca on Thursday, just shattered now if it's cancelled, but people are going to be nervous about taking it. When they hear you, you sound quite grave. You're using a word like crisis and everything. This is going to worry people.
Well, when I talk about the crisis, and what was really in my mind there was, our crisis is that COVID is still continuing to spread within our communities. I saw that as the main crisis. And then the fact that we want to do everything to counteract that, but we want to do it safely. And so these reports are serious, but they may be totally coincidental. We just don't have that information yet. And they were happening in younger age groups of people. I'm also, and we are conscious, that the people who have been targeted for the AstraZeneca vaccine this week include our very high risk groups who may have other underlying conditions that, if something is likely to trigger something, they may be more susceptible.
Okay,
so
Karina,
it really was just a pause.
I can feel people's confidence ebbing away here as you talk. These clots
fatal? Well, can I just
say,
Brendan, I'm sorry to cut across you, but
can I just say,
actually, guys, look at this in a way, this should increase your confidence in vaccination programs. What you want is, you want us to deliver safe programs. We are taking every measure to make sure that that is what we're doing. So, in fact, confidence will be lost if it was felt that there were safety signals that we were ignoring. So I would hope that we will be able to communicate to people that what we're doing is so that you can be confident in your vaccination program. And in fact, hopefully, if we're able to resume, that you will have even greater confidence that this has been looked at absolutely rigorously, absolutely thoroughly, and no, there was no need to worry. And we see this happening all the time with medications. We saw it in the trials of these vaccines at times. There was pauses when people looked, and then they resumed. And it's just that it's difficult because of the numbers that are involved, because of the logistics that are involved. But I think people would want us to do this, to just pause. We're not stopping. It's just holding till we get the information to see.
Okay.
And as I said,
how
all the preliminary information was reassuring, but this is a new development and we just have to wait and see what the investigation tells us.
Okay, how soon do you think we might know, Karina?
Well, that's a good question as well. The EMA have already, if you like, started a rapid review, and obviously other countries will be looking to this as well. We are also looking and seeking information on what the background rates are. Are there other factors that have contributed to this? Is this just a coincidence? And we would hope by the end of the week to have a conclusion. The conclusion at this stage is not certain, but I am certainly hopeful that I will be sitting this time next week and thinking, you know, we really didn't have to do that, but you know what? We're doing it so that we could make sure that everyone could have confidence in the vaccine program and that they can resume and know that it is safe going forward. But we have paused because there is a serious concern and we must await the outcome of those investigations.
Okay, but I see you're saying we hope here, we are overreacting. Listen, there's a question here from a texter, and this might actually be helpful for people out there worried. Had AstraZeneca first dose on Thursday evening. Should we be taking a daily aspirin to prevent a clot? It might seem like a silly question to you, but it might put people's mind at ease, should they?
I think that's a very good question. And we will be liaising with the experts in clotting to see whether, in fact, that might not be a sensible thing to do, just to take a low dose, 75 milligrams of aspirin once a day.
Okay,
but I will
so
get
I can just tell you now, that people are going to go and do that anyway now, I think, aren't they? It would do them no harm to do it, would it?
Well, in general, that's a very safe thing to do.
Yeah, okay. Okay, but you will be back quickly, you think, with information on that for people?
We will be putting up information on the National Immunization Office website. We will be developing frequently asked questions. We will seek answers to those questions from the experts in the area. We will put up, our whole goal in this program, Brendan, from the day one, has been transparency, to let people know. We'd love to just move all these ups and downs and the roads away, but that would not be fair to everybody. Our goal is to keep people informed, as difficult as it is, as hard as it is, to ask for the understanding. But really what we're trying to do is to do the best by everybody.
Absolutely. And look, Prof, I know it's a very, very busy morning for you, so we appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure that was very helpful for people. People can expect more information as the day goes on, can they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we will be putting up information, and as we get information, I don't think people should be expecting a conclusion to these investigations today or tomorrow. Realistically, that is going to be more towards the end of the week. But everything will be done to try and make sure that we continue with our vaccination program as safely and as quickly as we can, because we do know the benefits of vaccine. We do know the risks of COVID. We do have to get that risk balance right. And we may have tipped a little bit in one direction, and we may be able to counterbalance that as we get more information on board as the days go on this week. So thank you for allowing me explain to people what is going on. I'm more than happy to do so.
Well, thank you, Professor Karina Butler, Chair of NIAC. Our panel are here. Stephanie Preisner, writer and actor. Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs. And Sam McConkie of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the College of Surgeons. Good morning, everybody. Sam, I'll go to you first. What's your take on this?
I think it's really an abundance of caution. It's been very careful. Apparently, there have been four events that have happened in Norway that have led the Norwegian Medicine Authority to take action and to share this with us. I'd be wondering, are those four events the same? Is it four instances of the same rare problem, or is it four different things? And then the very good healthcare systems in Denmark, Norway and Iceland and UK. So it's possible at population level to see, is the incidence of this new four, whatever the event is, different in those who've been vaccinated recently versus the control population who haven't been vaccinated? And that, I expect, is what's going to be happening next week or two, to find out, is this vaccine, you know, chronologically, temporally linked to a higher rate of an unusual clotting problem. Rather than just aspirin, I'd be moving my feet and going for a walk, and those sticky stockings, and like we do on airplanes to prevent clots as well. And one of the problems with all of this sort of restrictions is that many of us are staying at home a lot as well, and maybe not doing as much physical exercise as before. So I think some people are doing more, of course, but others are doing less. So I think getting out and doing exercise really prevents some clots.
Okay, and I think Professor Butler did say there that they did seem to be quite rare and unusual, and that they were in young people. And you can see your point about that. A lot of vulnerable people with other conditions were to be getting that vaccine in the next week. Lucinda Creighton, what do you think of this?
It's hard to know. I mean, it's a devastating blow. I mean, we've already obviously had ongoing problems with the distribution of AstraZeneca vaccines. And I was listening to Luke O'Neill on this programme yesterday, where he was, recounting the extraordinary situation with the factory in the Netherlands, where there are, I think he said the shelves are creaking with AstraZeneca
vaccines. Yeah, no, I don't know if we know that exactly, but apparently they have been producing, and apparently they're not gone anywhere yet.
Exactly. So, so there's a huge frustration, obviously, on the supply side, and that we are hoping is getting resolved. And now, you know, this latest, I suppose, obstacle. I don't think we can criticise a cautious approach given the information that has emerged. I have looked and seen some commentary today from, for example, an individual called Mark Toshner, who is a lecturer in pulmonary and vascular disease in Cambridge University. And he, you know, he's certainly saying that he thinks this is an overreaction, that, you know, that the precautionary principle is almost going too far. But look, I mean, I hope...
Well, is an overreaction not better than an underreaction, I think, is
well,
Professor
Yeah,
Butler's
I mean,
point.
His point, I mean, it's a point of view. And I think the professor, gave a very comprehensive and credible overview just there at the top of this programme. His point of view is that, you know, there is a huge risk of all sorts of disease. There is a huge risk from COVID-19 itself, and that the cautious approach will actually deny people a vaccine that can save their lives in the coming weeks. Yeah. I wouldn't like to be making that decision. Yeah, you know, it's a really difficult call.
What is caution? And
hopefully it'll be no more than a week, you know.
Stephanie?
Yeah, you know, it is like everyone is saying, it's a difficult position for them to be in. I guess what's important to say is that in clinical trials, no trends or patterns were seen with regard to the pulmonary embolism or the deep vein thrombosis. But this was always going to happen, you know. If you take any intervention that's kind of rolled out to a whole population of a globe, there are going to be associations that are made that need to be investigated and then kind of get shelved. But my concern is that every time that we have something like this that needs the vaccination rollout paused, it adds a kind of another layer to the hesitancy or the fears that, or the safety concern fears. And that's kind of a petri dish for anti-vaxxers to come out with their fears in the space between
the... They're having a field day today.
Yeah, field day today. But I think if we take the... But, you know, if they weren't looking into it, it would be very, very concerning. And the risk of coronavirus will almost certainly outweigh the risk of this vaccine. I think that hopefully, if that's what they'll find. And we saw, for example, four cases of this in Norway. Last week, we saw four or five cases being revealed about COVID placentitis. And we can't pause the spread of COVID while we look into those, you know. So it's good that we do have the ability to pause this while we look into it. But I hope that it doesn't... Well, one, I hope that it's all fine and that we can continue the rollout and that people don't lose too much faith, because the one thing that we do know is slowing down vaccination programmes does cost lives. So I do hope it gets resolved soon.
Absolutely. Moving to the broader issue of the vaccine rollout, which is exercising a lot of the papers today. Sam, you picked that front page on the Sunday Independent. That's the interview Maeve Sheehan has with Brian McCrae.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously the huge story. Why can't we get more of this? And he's saying that he has got confidence that we will have, you know, large number of doses in April, May and June of this year. Thankfully, another company, hopefully Johnson & Johnson or Janssen, will be able to supply a lot of those. And then, as you probably know, a Russian-made vaccine, Gamaleya, in Moscow, makes Sputnik V, so that has been gone to European Medicine Agency for review, so it may be a fifth one. And then one called Novavax is a sixth. There are also three new companies in India and three in China who are making vaccines. So this field is opening up perhaps to 12 players over the next few months. And that will really, I think, improve the supply chain. So I think this is a story that will sort of solve itself just through commercial production of good products over a period of time.
Yeah, we just maybe a little bit of patience. Lucinda, you picked out in the Mail on Sunday this story about the chaos of the vaccine rollout, particularly on this confusion around the 12-week issue, which was just announced. Carina Butler Thursday night, Friday morning said, yeah, we could stretch the gap to 12 weeks, but that's not the whole story here.
No, I mean, so the article in the Mail on Sunday sort of recounts a series of questions from Richard Bruton, TD, to the Minister for Health, where, you know, there was a lot of, how would I put it, a lack of clarity in terms of what the plan is in terms of extending the period between the first dose and the second, as they've done in the UK, I think, quite successfully. And there's mounting evidence from all quarters where there is prolific vaccination that an extended gap is very effective, and that the first dose gives huge protection to pretty much everybody who receives the vaccine.
Or it turns out.
Well, the HSE has, it appears now, announced that there will be a 12-week gap between.
And that they have been doing a 12-week gap policy from the outset.
For quite some time, exactly. Yeah. But the Department of Health, or at least the Minister, didn't appear to be aware of that. And I saw in another paper, Gabriel Scally advocating for that practice
that was in the Business Post
to come into effect. So it appears that he wasn't aware either of what had
well,
become
no, I know Gabriel Scally
practice.
Knows everything, but he is not part of the apparatus.
Oh,
of
no,
the
exactly.
State, so it's understandable.
Absolutely.
He didn't know nobody.
No,
knew,
and but, I don't mean it, I don't minister. Mean it as a reflection on him. Yeah, I mean it more in the sense of there's such confusion reigning in all of the different state agencies and entities responsible, most particularly in the Department of Health.
And I think the problem with these things is that they do feed into a possible kind of, I think there. I think we're all accepting now that there is a fatigue, aren't we, Stephanie? And that you picked out Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Indoor saying the government, the headline is a quote from, I think, some insider saying the government will have a revolution on its hands if things are not better by June. But there's a general sense across the papers of things starting to fray a bit, isn't there?
Oh, like across all of the papers today, it's like anyone who's ever written an article has written an article about what they think should be happening and who's doing what wrong and where we should be getting vaccines, and someone knows a man in America who has them. You know, like it's getting that bananas. But sure, you look at then breaking news today, how can a government be expected to have a rollout when stuff like this is happening this morning with AstraZeneca? And I know I'm always, I have to believe that everyone is trying their best, because otherwise I'll break down. I have to believe that people are trying. But how there's, you know, there's people saying there's going to be a revolution, the government are going to collapse, someone's going to lose his head. But how can somebody's career or an entire government be only stable if this vaccine rolls out, when, if this vaccination rollout happens, when we're at the mercy of so many other players? And I know people are tired, I'm exhausted, but like, our numbers are higher now than they were before Christmas. There's huge criticism about what happened to Christmas and what it led to, the fact that we're still in here, and yet for some reason people are still scrambling to get out, even though that would just lead to another issue that we find ourselves in. So I think what it is at the moment, like across all the papers, it's just this free floating rage where it just, it's like embers, and it will just go from one person to the other. Everyone, some person in government or in NPHET or someone will get it every day. And today it seems to be about the vaccine rollout, or where we should go to find vaccines. And people are offering reasonable, you know, well, it seems reasonable in theory, but it's very reasonable to form an opinion when you don't have to be the one to go to, you know.
Yeah.
Ask for the.
Well, look, I suppose it makes a change from discussing zero COVID, which we could.
Oh, thank God. That's
but I do think, I mean, I think it's reasonable for people to be frustrated by the process in relation to the procurement and the execution and the rollout of vaccines. Because, I mean, you know, this nightmare has been going on for 12 months. I think people are entitled to feel extraordinarily frustrated.
But this nightmare hasn't been happening for 12 months. It has developed.
And when you see that, for example, example, the task force for COVID-19 vaccinations was only convened in November. We were the last member state in the EU to convene a task force for the rollout, for the procurement and rollout of the vaccine. And that's in the terms of reference for that group. They were convened, I think, on the 23rd of November.
They did say at the time, I remember, though, that they were building on extensive work that had been done by the HSE up to then.
Well, yes, but as it transpires, you know, the level, the efficiency and efficacy of that work is, I think, questionable. When you look at the fact that other member states were in a position at an early stage to bid for excess vaccines, some of the French didn't want AstraZeneca, Germans didn't want AstraZeneca, Germany secured additional supply from Pfizer, etc. The Irish appear to have been completely absent from those moves at European level, and I think it's acceptable and it's actually logical for people to be annoyed and frustrated by that, because at the end of the day, people are locked in their homes, their businesses have been shut down or are kept artificially on life support. Many of them will never reopen their doors. That's the reality. And I think I certainly am frustrated, and I think many people around the country are as well. They want to see a sense of purpose from government. It's not to say that this is easy. It's not to say that there are simple solutions. There aren't. But they want to see a sense of purpose and conviction and action. And that has been lamentably absent, it appears
no,
to me.
Let's go on.
I disagree with part of it. Like, I have to say with you, Lucinda, because it's so easy to sit here and criticise government, but a government that only formed this time last year and stepped into a pandemic, I think, yes, of course they could be doing better things, but to for all the papers to be criticising government, it doesn't help anyone. People are trying, and Ireland, as part of Europe, has procured. If we weren't in Europe, little old Ireland with its begging hat, we wouldn't have the vaccines that we even have now. So I do think that people are trying.
I totally support the European procurement process. It has let us down, that's for sure. I think we absolutely are right to be part of it. But the Danes are part of it. The Maltese are part of it. The Germans are part of it. But they found other solutions in parallel.
You can do they are looking. No one has spare vaccines.
Yeah, I can understand a lot of the anxiety. We're in a time of great unpredictability and change. The world has done a turn that none of us could have conceived 5 or 10 years ago. So leading through that as a government is very challenging. And of course, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people not working who were working a few years ago. So this is a huge loss of productivity. And I to me, it's the productivity of our country is the only thing we have to ensure our future wealth. If we don't really have productivity, we won't continue to be able to afford the standard of living we enjoy. And people will have to change. There's this realization now, as we've heard, that some businesses won't open. So there'll be a lot of change. People have to change to different occupations. And that's not easy news to say to anyone. It is up to our government to lead that, to provide whether it's apprenticeships or adult education and support to help people move into those new jobs. Because we've lots of jobs and employment where we need more people. And then we've lots of people who aren't trained to do those particular jobs. So there's a real need for adult education, and I haven't seen that yet come to the fore.
I think there's a bit of it going on, yeah, but I'm conscious too that it's very easy for us all to sit here and tell people who are sitting out there, some of them not having worked for a year, that they need to go in and retrain for another job. Listen, just on a kind of a related note to this, Paul Cullen, who's the health editor of the Irish Times, is on the line now. Good morning, Paul. Are you there, Paul?
Good morning, Brendan.
Hi, Paul. Paul, on a related issue then, I suppose, in the government's response to this and everything, you were asking an interesting question in your piece in the Irish Times yesterday, and you asked it on Thursday night at the NPHET press conference, which is that a lot of people would like to know, where are these cases coming from, and have we got any handle on that? Because I suppose the kind of thinking behind your question is that we've the whole country locked down at the moment now. It's a blunt instrument for, you know, what are a relatively small number of cases that we can't figure out where it's happening.
Yeah, it was okay for 2 months since Christmas when they were going down. And then this week they started going up again, and that raised a frightening vista for people, obviously, that we could be facing another wavelet or a wave. More measures might be necessary rather than easing of measures. So you're right. I mean, the question is where are those cases coming down? I did point out that in 10 or 11 counties at the moment, you know, the daily number of cases are in single digits. So there's an uneven geographical spread. consistently, and I've been going to these briefings now for a year, there's a lack of information coming out about the origin of cases. We do occasionally hear issues that are raised by the media, for example, the student parties of a few weeks ago. On occasion, public health doctors have been brought into NPHET briefings and they've given very good on-the-ground information about how single cases can spread through restaurants and hotels and funerals and so on. But by and large, we're given the broad, blunt instrument of lockdown and we're told it's too much mixing, or in the words of the last week, that there's too much mobility. But that doesn't, that kind of doesn't, there's no granularity about that and doesn't tell us exactly what is going on. And after a year, I think, and given the length of the lockdown and the simmering anger that your panelists have referred to, I think we are due more than that. But we seem to be caught in a kind of a loop where we have too many cases per day for our public health doctors and staff to be able to trace the origins of those cases sufficiently. And it just goes around in a circle because we can't get the cases down to a low number, which would allow for elaborate and comprehensive contact tracing that you see in other countries.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Sam, that idea of looking at the counties where levels are low now, and I saw Gabriel Scally was saying it again on Katie yesterday, that... And remember, we did lock down counties that were high at one stage in the innocent days of living with COVID. Is it time to start looking at breaking this down again a bit more?
I agree with everything that Paul Cullen just said and with Gabriel Scally's idea that a local approach that takes account of the both strengths and weaknesses of the epidemiology of COVID in that area is really wise. So in Cork and Kerry, or even Leitrim, Sligo, Cavan, they're very low numbers. If they were to get down essentially to zero, then perhaps domestic things like, you know, pubs, restaurants, outdoor football and so on could open up in that area. The issue is the border with those counties, entering them and leaving them would have to stay very tightly controlled because it could very easily be reintroduced.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to do that is the reality.
Well, that's the challenge. Yeah. And then is county the best unit? Because we have commuting zones, many of them, you know, across county lines, like many people live in Kildare and work in Dublin or live in Meath and work in Dublin, similarly in Sligo. So we have commuting zones might be a better unit than county. The other countries, just to parallel Australia, New Zealand, New Zealand famously, every time there's an outbreak, they tell the world, they tell everyone publicly the context of that outbreak. They talk about the Auckland outbreak in such a restaurant. So they don't name individuals with the disease with COVID because that's private personal health information. Yeah. But they do say that there's an outbreak at this location in Auckland and we've closed down to control
And you get a text
that.
Message to say if you were in such a place at such a time and whatever. But like in fairness, and I think this was the point, Paul Cullen, that Ronan Glynn made back to you the other night, as you've alluded to there, which is that at 500 plus cases, that kind of granularity cannot be done. Stephanie and Lucinda, you both picked out stories that relate to, I guess, the reality of what's going on outside of COVID in people's lives that's being impacted by this lockdown. Lucinda, do you tell us about, there's an extraordinary story in the Mail on Sunday on page 4 about children with eating disorders.
Yeah, I suppose in a sense, you know, I wasn't surprised reading this story, but at the same time, it's shocking. So effectively, it is evidence from Crumlin Children's Hospital and Professor Fiona McNicholas, who is a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist, has spoken on the record about the fact that they have seen the number of children presenting in Irish hospitals with eating disorders, they have increased by more than threefold. So when you think about it, so the number of children presenting with eating disorders, that, you know, I think, you know, the conclusion being drawn by healthcare professionals is that it is very much linked to lockdown for, you know, I'm sure a whole variety of reasons. It is just shocking and alarming. And I think it really brings home the fact that, you know, while we in our health system is so focused and has to be on COVID-19 and its direct, you know, health implications in terms of case numbers and ICU admissions and unfortunately deaths, there are all of these side effects on the wider population from the point of view of other health issues and specifically mental health issues. And like to see that those numbers spiralling out of control amongst our younger population is hugely concerning.
And in a sad way, then I think a lot of people won't be surprised at that. Yeah. Anyone who's seeing what's going on with kids, teenagers and older kids and everything. Yeah. I mean, I think there's untold damage being done to them.
The reason that it's so alarming is because there was 10 million in the budget for government so eating disorders are the most dangerous mental health issue. They have the most morbidity, particularly anorexia. It's what they see the most deaths from. Mark Smith, who used to be the president of the Psychology Society of Ireland, said that if two people came to him and one of them had suicidal ideation and the other had an eating disorder, the person with the eating disorder was the most likely to face mortality because of that, which is so alarming. Then there was 10 million redirected away from eating disorders into other budgets, into other health budgets. Now that has been reinstated, 3.9 million of that, don't quote me, but around that, has been reinstated for eating disorder hubs. And it says in that article, you know, it's understandable when children particularly are faced with the pandemic that they can't understand it, they don't know what's happening. The way that they control, what they can control is food. And what they're seeing is kids over-exercising, under-eating, restricting their food, or some people overeating or turning to food to cope with what is happening. And this, you know, Mary Butler, who is the Minister for Mental Health, Minister of State with responsibility for mental health and older people, she needs to be looking at, like, these are significant mental health issues that are having an impact. And once there's herd immunity and we're back in pubs and restaurants and all this is happening and everyone's back to school, these things don't go away. Eating disorders are a wolf at the door for your entire life.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Cullen, would you agree with the broad spectrum of what's
been said there? Yeah, the point I would make is that there is no proper effort made to aggregate the effects, the economic, social, the non-COVID medical effects of this pandemic, to bring them all together so that we can put it into some sort of cost-benefit equation. We get the daily numbers and deaths every day, and as we should, but the other side of the coin is not aggregated in any formal way.
Yeah, OK.
I totally agree with that. I mean, in any policy-making environment, I mean, the first thing that you do, and in most cases it's enshrined in legislation, is you carry out a risk assessment.
But yeah, it's not
and there are no risk assessments here.
And remember we used to talk, a year ago about a cost-benefit analysis and all of this, but like I suppose it's impossible to do in a way. Paul Cullen, health editor of the Irish Times, thanks for that, and I'll let you go. Sam, can I just put all of that to you in terms of, I suppose really like, A year and 1 month ago, if anyone had said to you, let's put doctors in charge of the country, you know, there used to be a thing, doctors are good at running hospitals, not countries.
Well, I don't know. For me, the last 15 months have been rather exhausting and I'm certainly tired of it. And, you know, have the privilege to have lots of access to media and to various others to try and share my views
I'm not personalizing this to you. The point I'm making is that, do you think, have we over put too much emphasis on one single thing at just massive cost to everything else?
I think this idea that it's doctors running the country is fundamentally wrong. Now, I accept that Leo Varadkar is, I think, still registered with the Medical Council, but he's essentially a politician rather than a doctor.
I think anyone who says that NPHET isn't very firmly in the driving seat now, Sam, is deluded. They are, aren't they?
But no,
and nobody even argues anymore. It's like we wait for the advice from NPHET and they go with it.
Exactly. No, I disagree with that because NPHET are giving advice to the government. Our government are wholly and completely corporately responsible for the decisions they take, and they have to integrate not just different health issues, but also social issues, economic issues, cultural, religious, and the whole dimension of our society they're responsible for. So ultimately, the government, our cabinet, cannot shirk the responsibility of being the decision maker. And that's as it should be, as I understand it from our constitution. So NPHET are purely advisory. And the fact that the government are listening to NPHET is because that there is a pandemic on, and that's been killed 1,000 people in February, more than 1,000 in January, and you can't ignore a problem that's just killed 1,000 people in a month. So that's why they're listening to them. But there certainly are other considerations, and those are very, very valid, not only other health ones. The one that I've seen, and again would like to shout out, is actually domestic violence, that we're actually seeing violence mostly sadly against women in their own homes. And that, unfortunately, I believe both the data and my own experiences is seeing that rise, that people who are in difficult homes are actually getting worse and really suffering and Lucinda not able to get help.
Lucinda wants to come in there on that.
I think the point about domestic violence is really valid. And also, I mean, you can point to the experience of children with disabilities in particular and children from disadvantaged backgrounds who've been denied education and access to the services that they normally benefit from for, I think, 7 months. We've had the longest lockdown in the world from an education point of view. Our schools have been closed longer.
Our schools have been closed longer
than any other schools in the world. So, you know, the impact of that is horrendous. But just to Sam's point, I mean, yes, he's absolutely correct. Our cabinet and our government are legally and constitutionally responsible. But I think it's quite clear that ever since the surge in cases over Christmas, the cabinet has been gripped by fear and has been afraid to take any decisions that are in any way out of kilter with NPHET. So in effect, they have abdicated responsibility to NPHET.
Because NPHET the last time that they went against NPHET, we ended up in this situation.
I think the point that gets forgotten here is that NPHET wanted to open up NPHET advised to open up the country and they advised visiting in households from the beginning of December, which was a huge part of what happened after Christmas. Don't forget that.
But they were saying that would happen at the expense of something else. They weren't saying do that and all the other things.
Let's not forget that NPHET was advising level 3 as well, just so we're fair to everybody.
I think that's a fair point. And also, I mean, there is personal responsibility in this and how people behaved in some quarters.
We used to talk about personal responsibility was going to be the next phase.
We live in hope. But the other point, I think, which I think has really not been given due or fair consideration is, I mean, we were told in early January that the UK strain, members of NPHET came out to contradict the Taoiseach in saying that the UK strain had virtually no impact on the case numbers and the rise in case numbers. And that, I think, has been completely discredited, because quite clearly now over 70% of the cases are of the UK variant, and it is obviously highly transmissible.
And NPHET tell us every week. They told us again the other night that the only reason that we're in the position we're in now, I hear cases might be in the cases might be in single figures or the 20s now. They're saying
in fairness to the government, nobody in government knew in November when the decisions were being taken about the easing of restrictions that this variant was going to come and rip its way through the country. So that, you know, that is a factor which is kind of overlooked.
Sam, I'll come back to you then.
That our really good restrictions in from the December the 26th for the following 2 months have really controlled all the non-B117 transmission in Ireland. And that's nearly, as we said, down single fingers eliminated. But it has not yet controlled the B117, which has emerged now as by far the dominant variant. So our current level of restrictions
alone are not sufficient. That comes back to the question then. I saw Ronan Glynn said in his little video that he put out on Friday night or last night but he said we're dealing with a new virus here. So Sam, is the reality from your point of view, do you think that if we open up at all, because of the UK variant, is this just going to kick off again? And is that what we're seeing around Europe as well?
So the bigger question is the vaccine alone, at high levels of vaccination, as they've done in Israel or Scotland, will that be enough to let us open up and be happy partying again? And there is a natural experiment going on in Israel right now, because they've vaccinated about 56% of their adult population. Now they're partying. For the last week, they're out partying and having cheers to Pfizer and so on. And in 2 to 3 weeks' time, we will see whether their rates of death and disease start to go up again in the non-vaccinated population. Unfortunately,
medium term, I think people are probably a bit short term in their thinking at the moment. So we know that there's nothing much happening for us on April 5th and probably not for another 6 weeks then. But is the bottom line here that the UK variant means that we cannot really open up the country to any extent, at least until there is a large portion of the population vaccinated?
Yeah, I think we need to do more than vaccinate. And I put out, 20 things on Twitter that the government could do more of, and at journal.ie, 10 things that they could do more of. That's things like faster contact tracing, more accessible GP, address the housing crowding problem, things like retrospective contact tracing, which many of us have been saying for months, and now it sounds like they're going to try and bring in, and local contact teams that would actually go to the sites of whether it's restaurants or factories or private houses to help people do a deep clean. clean and to help them with their isolation? Do they have needs for shopping, for caring for elders, for childcare that they need met, and to help the people who are in isolation to isolate better and quicker? So I think there's a lot more we could do
that would still bring it on. Comes right back down to the question that we saw it again on primetime the other night. It comes down to the question of resourcing public health locally all around the country, doesn't it? Listen, just before we leave this, Stephanie and Lucinda, you both picked another piece in the Mail about parents wanting the cutting of the summer holidays. Stephanie, do you want to tell us about that?
Well, do you want to go to Lucinda first, seeing as she has children in school?
Do you know what? You have a voice and your voice can be heard. Everyone's voice can be heard.
I don't think I'm ever more afraid than when I'm talking about teachers. There's just nothing that inflames people. But anyway,
you could need them someday to always remember that.
I know, yeah. I think, so there's a call for parents want schools, either school days longer or holidays shorter to make up for the time. I am of the opinion that school has... now is not the time to be cutting a break for people. Like, people need a break. They need a psychological break. They need to not be in front of a computer.
Okay, I can see no way you didn't want to talk, because the parents are all going to do is, you don't understand, a break means them going to school. Kids are even thinking at this stage that a break means them going to school. Lucinda, what do you think of that proposal?
Well, I mean, I just pointed out that Ireland has had the longest closure of schools globally. So, certainly our children are way behind. In fairness, this recent lockdown was not like March, April, May, June. It was that long last year when there really was no homeschooling at all. I mean, there was no remote teaching. This time, actually, I think most teachers really tried, and it was challenging for them. It's very difficult teaching remotely. It's very difficult teaching in person at home as well, let me tell you. I think it is slightly different. But there are cohorts of children who have really missed out. As I mentioned earlier, children with special needs, children from disadvantaged backgrounds who perhaps didn't have the space or the technology. And what they're doing in the UK, the government is putting in place summer schools funded by the government.
It's a no-brainer.
So it's not saying to teachers, you lose your summer holidays, but they presumably have the option of opting in. So maybe getting paid for their time.
And in civil society, there might be other people who would get involved.
Exactly.
I think summer schools with an element of activity and an element of academics to them
as
well. It's an
absolute no-brainer.
With a focus
on socialising them, I think.
All of that.
Sit down
and
learn. Yeah.
And I think the Minister for Education has had a very difficult and challenging time, and she's obviously been criticised a lot, over leaving certain various other things. But I think this is something really positive that she and the government could do for children.
I'm not supposed to have opinions here, but 100% with you on that one. Okay, our panel staying with us, Lucinda Creighton, Sam McConkey and Stephanie Preisner. We'll take a quick break and then we are going to sort out the royal family.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Lucinda Creighton, Sam McConkey and Stephanie Preisner still with us. And it seems that the UK may be missing having the civil war of Brexit. Had a new civil war this week over Harry and Meghan. Stephanie, why don't we start with you? Where do you stand on this, the burning issue of the day?
So I can't find what paper it's in, but it's like, this is the biggest crisis in, Buckingham Palace history. And I just find
I think it's in all the papers.
It's in all the papers. But that sort of headline and that sort of rhetoric, which I think is fascinating based on the fact that... what's the name of the Prince Andrew? Last year was accused of being in cahoots with Jeffrey Epstein, which surely is a bigger crisis, or the crisis with Diana. That this is really the one that they feel, because public opinion is so focused on Meghan, and I think so pro Meghan in many cases, that they are really seeing that this is the one that they need to take action on.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Lucinda, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts are well encapsulated by my fellow columnist in the Business Post, Vincent Bolan, who says, nobody could take Harry and Meghan as seriously as they take themselves. I think it's the most narcissistic, vacuous stuff that I've ever come across.
Did you watch it?
Of course I did. So what else is there to do on a Monday night?
The issue is that the vacuousness is also is sort of side by side with some very serious things that Meghan is saying about how she has felt. And so it's easy to kind of shirk them off and say that it's vacuous. But that's why we're kind of struggling to be like, is this serious or not?
Eilish O'Hanlon makes an interesting point.
I think her column is great today. Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah.
She basically says, yes, this is how they feel, But if you're, and they get to speak their truth, but if your truth impinges on someone else's reality, like if my truth is that you are a racist, you're allowed to answer back and you're allowed to doubt me.
Yeah,
and if my truth is that you didn't help me with my mental health when, as Eilish points out, Charles went to therapy, well known. Margaret was put into the Priory, well known. Harry's been in therapy for 7 years.
Two of those things that can exist at the same time. Like two of our truths can be true at the same time, which is the issue. But there is a bang of like, oh my God, gold is so heavy. Off it, like, where it's like, okay, lads, you need to calm down as well now.
Yeah, fair enough. Sam McConkey, you probably don't have time really for this kind of nonsense, do you?
No, Brendan, I'm sorry. I'm probably one of the population who's sort of a channel hopper. As soon as I see this story come up on TV, I hop to a different channel. So I just have no interest in it whatsoever. I do respect the Queen greatly for her hard work, for her dignity, and for her sense of duty to her job. So I have great respect for the Queen of England. And you know, but for me now, this is just, you know, remote from my life. I was lying.
Oh, I know, but you got
it.
You got in the
dig,
nonetheless. Like the Queen and duty, like, and we know what you're saying about the two of them. You didn't need to use the word vacuous and narcissistic, but yeah, you got it across there, Sam. All right. Listen, there's a far more serious story been knocking around the UK for the last week as well, and we saw. It come to a kind of an unfortunate culmination last night, really. The terrible story of Sarah Everard, and then leading to last night, this vigil that seems to have ended up in, I don't know, either heavy-handed police or people misbehaving, or that we don't know enough, I think, yet. Stephanie, you've probably been following all this. Just explain to people briefly the story and how it has captured the imagination of people.
So very briefly, Sarah Everard was a woman in London, was at her friend's house, walked home on the phone to her boyfriend for some part of it and then not on the phone, went missing. There were missing posters up for her. Then her body was found and a police officer has been arrested and charged with her murder. There was outcry, women coming out saying, it really struck a nerve because so many women relate to this feeling of not being safe walking home. We've all felt it. I see Lucinda nodding in studio. I have felt it. It's been as a woman, you are, you know, your friends give you tips and tricks on what to do when you're walking home. Hold your keys between your fingers so that if someone comes at you, you can hit them and injure them. Pretend to be on the phone. Don't walk in dark areas. And it's just such a woman focused blame rather than men all sitting around being like, how can we make sure that we don't intimidate women? Not only how do we make sure that we don't rape women, but how to make sure we make women comfortable when they're walking in the street. So then there was a vigil.
How do we do that?
How do men do that? Mm. Okay, so a couple of things you could do. Don't walk directly behind women. Make sure that we can see your face. Try and walk ahead of us if you're walking at nighttime.
I think I sometimes worry then that if they start speeding up to walk around and go in front of women, or if they cross the road, that they're going to make a woman nervous.
No, yeah, our heart will probably race for a little bit just as you're overtaking us, but it's always safer for us to feel like you're ahead of us than behind us because we can watch you.
We shouldn't say anything or anything. See, again, like you'd be tempted to say, look, I'm grand, I'm just going around you.
You could say that when you're walking around in a nice tone, but don't be, you know, I wouldn't start a conversation, just keep walking. Don't pull up next to a woman in your car, don't stare, don't run at a woman from behind. If you see a woman walking alone, keep your distance. And if a woman confides in you that something has happened, believe her, help her, tell her to go to the police. There's lots of things that can be done. And this vigil happened last night for Sarah, and the police again were saying, please don't come because of COVID, this isn't allowed, no mass gatherings. And women were saying, how dare you, as the police, as the institution that caused this issue, because one of the man has been a police officer, again tried to tell women where we cannot be. And some of the
The police are telling everyone where they cannot be at the moment, aren't they, Lucinda? Is it different if the cause is okay? Is it different? No, are you allowed to gather?
No, I think this has come up in Ireland where, you know, certain gatherings have been sort of excused and others haven't.
This is Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, as compared to the other gathering a couple of weeks ago, which obviously ended in huge controversy. So I think if there's a rule in place, then it has to be sort of agenda neutral. It has to be, you know, mass gatherings are not allowed. They're prohibited. So don't do it. And in fairness to the organisers of that gathering in London, as far as I understand it, they asked people to stay at home and to light a candle rather than showing up. But of course, you know, and understand, look, it's hugely emotive.
Even Kate Middleton was there.
Yeah, exactly.
Like she came
people,
out to
people wanted to show solidarity, and you know this is a huge issue, and it's just really struck a nerve. I think as Stephanie has really well articulated, like it every woman can relate to this story. I mean, bar none, I would say. So, and it's just so shocking to think that this woman disappeared, that a police officer, somebody who's trusted with, you know, are protecting us and ensuring our security, was the one responsible. Yeah. So
and the rhetoric around it was, why did she walk home on her own?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Lucinda Creighton, Stephanie Prisoner and Sam McConkie. We'll take a quick break.